1 Samuel 18, 1 through 4. As soon as he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit together with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul, too, and Saul took him that day and would not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David, and his armor, and even his sword, and his bow, and his belt. In chapter 19, verses 1 through 7, Saul spoke to Jonathan, his son, and to all his servants that they should kill David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David. And Jonathan told David, "Saul, my father seeks to kill you. Therefore, be on your guard in the morning. Stay in a secret place and hide yourself. And I will go up and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak to my father about you. And if I learn anything, I will tell you." And Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and he said to him, "Let not the king sin against his servant David, because he has not sinned against you, and because his deeds have brought good to you. For he took his life in his hand, and he struck down the Philistine, and the Lord worked a great salvation for all of Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by killing David without cause?" And Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan. Saul swore, "As the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death." And Jonathan called David, and Jonathan reported to him all these things. And Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as before. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
This morning's sermon is going to be a little bit different than what we've been doing in this series. We've been talking, we've been journeying through the life of David, looking at these snapshots in David's life where David is interacting with another character, whether that's Goliath or Saul or Samuel. But usually what we're learning there is the contrast between David and this other person, or we're learning something from the action in the narrative in that text. This week, I want to look a little bit more closely at this actual relationship between David and Jonathan, look in detail and to see how it progresses and what we can learn about it across these three chapters. What we read from 1 Samuel 18 and 19, we're going to talk a little bit about 1 Samuel 20 as well. This morning, I really want to talk about friendship and what the Bible has to teach us about friendship. And I think it's a really important topic for all of us. Friendships are something that all of us want. We all seem to desperately want and need, but often we don't have them. Often we don't know where to find them or how to cultivate them. Increasingly in our world, we've become more individualized and lonelier. We were cut off from relationships more and more. But there is this strong draw in all of us, especially if we move to a new area, if we start a new job, if you're newer to Fairview. How do you build these friendships and these relationships? We have a couple of friends visiting us this week, and they reminded me that when I first got to college, there really was not a whole lot of Christian community there. And so I became good friends with my friend Rachel, who's here today, and we spent a lot of time together as freshmen, and I remember complaining, like, there aren't a lot of guys who I can have this close relationship with and this close friendship with. And Rachel has an older brother named Stefan, whose wife is also here today, and Rachel told me, "Tim, you're an idiot. You and Stefan should be best friends, and you should start this community yourselves." And I'm not sure she called me an idiot. That might have been a paraphrase. Probably wasn't. Anyway, Rachel was right, and Stefan and I tried to start this community, and we tried to build all these close relationships, and we had a lot of fun. We were somewhat successful. We made a lot of mistakes, but that experience of trying to build relationships was one of the most important ones of my life. Unfortunately for everybody else, the Tim and Stefan playbook for friendship involves a lot of time spent together, skipping class and going to Waffle House at midnight, so it's not necessarily universally applicable to our lives today. On the bright side, the Bible is universally applicable, and it has a great deal to teach us at friendship throughout the entire Bible, specifically here with David and Jonathan, but we'll test the edges a little bit. This morning, we're going to go with God's plan instead of my plan, and we'll talk first about how we were created for community and friendship, Second, what we can learn specifically from the example of Jonathan. And finally, what this really means for our lives. So first, we were created for community. You know, there's always some group of scientists that are studying friendship, which I really appreciate. And one of them out of UVA recently did brain scans on people under the threat of an electric shock. And so what they were comparing was how the brain functions, whether you yourself are about to get shocked, or a close friend of yours is about to get shocked, or a complete stranger. And what they found is that our brains don't distinguish between when we are going to get shocked and when a close friend of ours is. It's the exact same in terms of brain function. So we are naturally empathetic for those that we care about. Our concern is equal to our self-concern. Now, I find this to be fascinating because it shows that on a subconscious level, we are relational beings. We are naturally empathetic, but it really shouldn't be surprising for us because we should already know that that's what we were created for, community. You know, a lot of the times when we as Christians, we look back at Genesis and we look back at creation and we talk about what order things were done and how long was each day and which animals were present at which point. And, you know, that, I get that. There's a lot of important conversations that begin with Genesis 1. But in my opinion, one of the most important and crucial aspects of creation is that we were all male and female. We know this. We were all created in the image of God. And we know that God himself dwells in community. That God exists in a trinity, in this perfect internal fellowship between the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. So to be created in God's image also means that we were created to be in relationship. In fact, if we look in Genesis 1 at a little bit more detail, we see a pattern emerge, right? So God creates something. He creates the light or the land and the sea or plants and animals or suns and stars. And there's a common refrain that we hear. Does anyone remember what he says after creating all of those things? And it was good, absolutely. And then we get to God creating man, and he creates Adam, and he looks at him, and what does he say? He said, it is not good. It is not good for man to be alone. That's close. You can try again next week. So we try to live lives on our own. When we live like an island without connection to our brothers and sisters, we are violating this essential aspect of our created order, a part of our purpose. Yet constantly we do this, right? Constantly we build moats to keep ourselves apart from others. We use technology to limit our face-to-face interaction. We live further out, or we live on a plot of land, so we don't have to interact with our neighbors on a daily basis. There are a ton of studies that examine American individualization, and the idea is that Americans naturally, we keep more physical and emotional and relational space between us and other people than most other cultures do. Now, a lot of those things aren't done intentionally to divide us from others, but the byproduct is that we live increasingly separate lives. We're increasingly focused on self-reliance and independence and personal space and comfort and convenience. But that is contrary to what we were created for. We were created for community, and there's a really intense beauty in that purpose. So imagine what that could look like in your life, this idea that you were created to live in relationship, that whatever you might be currently facing, whatever experience in your life or hardship or trial that you're encountering are not things that you should be facing alone. When you feel lost in anxiety or concern, it's not a burden for you to carry alone. When you're facing a scary health situation or financial concerns, you should not be alone in that. When you have questions about why do bad things happen to the world? You know, does God really exist? How do you better love your neighbor? How do you better raise your children? These are not questions or thoughts that we're supposed to answer on our own, but things that we're supposed to answer in community and in relationship. See, all of us have this proclivity, this tendency to individualize all the difficulties of our lives so we can come up with our own thoughts, our own strategies. But the Bible makes it very clear that the Christian life is not supposed to be an individual sport. And if you're doing it alone, you are not doing it correctly. We need friends. God created us as relational beings who are built for community and empathy and fellowship. So second, let's look at what we can learn more specifically from the example of Jonathan. If we look a little closer at Jonathan and David's relationships, that's, again, it spans not just these three chapters, but a wide piece of David's life, early life. But I think there's three characteristics that really set Jonathan's friendship for David apart from others. First, there's Jonathan's love for David. Second, his commitment to David. And finally, his sacrifice for David. So we'll talk about those this morning. First, Jonathan's love for David. Now, there's a book called The 11 Indispensable Relationships That You Can't Live Without. And it was written by Leonard Sweet, who's a theologian and a church historian. He's also a Methodist, which we won't hold against him this morning. But in this book, he talked about these important types of relationships, these biblical relationships that we have examples of, and how each of them are pivotal for our lives. So, for instance, he'd say, you need a Nathan in your life, meaning that you need someone who will edit and correct you. You need a Barnabas, or someone who will encourage you. You need a Timothy, or a protege to pour into and invest in. And his model for Jonathan was that everyone needs a true friend, because that's what Jonathan represents in the Bible, the best friend, the true friend, the friend who loves you at all times, who has this deep and abiding affection for you that knows no bounds. David and Jonathan's relationship starts with their mutual affection and their love for one another. That's what we read right away in chapter 18. We see this love that is apparent. Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Their affinity and their affection were the foundation for all of the action that happened later. All the other aspects of their relationship are based on this love and affinity. You know, last week we talked about David and Saul in chapter 18, where we saw David's dynamic with King Saul, where Saul was so envious and angry and fearful and homicidal when it came to David. And now those feelings are bracketed by the text we read this morning, by the story of David and Jonathan. So we can see Jonathan's intense love for David as in complete contrast to Saul's fear and hate and anger. So second, Jonathan's commitment to David and how that lines up with the love. So in our world, we use love. The word love often means, it describes a feeling, right? Love is something that you feel. You're falling into love. You feel love. Love, the feeling of love can be very temporary. It can fade over time. When I do premarital counseling, I use this assessment called Prepare and Enrich. And one of the things that it measures is this section called idealistic distortion. And now what they do is they ask couples a few questions, like, do you ever think you'll be less in love with your spouse than you currently are? Do you anticipate having major issues that cause you to think about whether or not you should be married in your marriage? And they ask these questions, and basically they're trying to measure what degree are people who are engaged, are they blindly in love, and are they seeing their relationship through rose-colored glasses? Because if they are, if they have this unrealistic depiction of that their love will never fade over time, then they won't be prepared for when it does. They won't be prepared for trouble when it comes. Because it always comes, doesn't it? All relationships have ups and downs. Feelings of love can ebb and flow with the seasons, which is why the commitment or the covenant that you make with your spouse, or that we see here in the text that David and Jonathan make a covenant with one another, that's why the covenant and the commitment are so important. Tim Keller wrote a great book on marriage, and he talks about this dilemma where feelings of love can fade. He writes, "When that happens, you must remember that the essence of a marriage is a covenant, a commitment, a promise of future love. So what do? You do the acts of love, despite your lack of feeling. You may not feel tender or sympathetic or eager to please, but in your actions, you must be tender, understanding, forgiving, and helpful. And if you do that, as time goes on, you will not only get through these dry spells, but they will become less frequent and deep, and you will become more constant in your feelings. That is what can happen if you decide to love." See, love is not just a feeling, it is a decision when we factor in commitment and covenant. Are we committing to our relationships this way? Are we committing to our friendships not only when you want to, but also when your friends annoy you, when you disagree with them, when they cause you pain? See, David and Jonathan cut a covenant together. That's what the Hebrew says literally. They cut a covenant, meaning they committed to each other. They put their own lives on the line to show their dedication and that their feelings would not ebb and flow. Their relationship would not be dependent on the current situation or the environment. Are we that committed to our friendships and our relationships? Finally, Jonathan's sacrifice for David. The great poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge once wrote that love is like a flower, but friendship is like a sheltering tree. See, Jonathan is that tree who's protecting David at all times. He's advocating for him. This morning we read of Jonathan advocating on behalf of David, trying to convince his father not to kill him. In chapter 20, the next chapter, there's this amazing story where Jonathan protects David. David is again concerned because Saul is repeatedly trying to kill him. That's a fair concern. So he and Jonathan come up with a plan for how to handle this. David is going to skip this feast, and Jonathan is going to go. And if Saul misses him and he asks, where is David, then Jonathan will explain that David had asked permission to go home and make a sacrifice, and that Jonathan had granted that request. So if Saul is okay with David's absence, then they would know that David was safe to return. But if Saul was angry that Jonathan had let David leave, then they would know that Saul still had aims to kill David and that David was still in danger. So they make this plan and they commit to it, and they have this whole language of recommitting to this covenant, and everything goes according to plan. Saul gets angry. He throws a spear at Jonathan, at his own son, for letting David leave. And so Jonathan goes out to the field and he warns David, and David flees the city. Now, what makes this story even more amazing, even more remarkable, is the sacrifice that Jonathan makes for David. You see, Jonathan is the son of Saul. He's the crown prince of Israel, who would most likely have been the next king, except for this fact that we know that God had rejected Saul and had sent Samuel to anoint David to replace him. But still, you know, in terms of the government and all of the structure, Saul is not recognizing that anointment. Saul is still king even after David's anointing. David is not king, and it doesn't feel like people are eager to replace Saul. So from an earthly perspective, Jonathan is kind of still in the line of kingship. But we see in verse 4, in 18:4, that as soon as he meets him, Jonathan strips himself of his robe, his armor, his sword, his bow, his belt, all of the trappings of his status, all of the markings that he is royalty and will take control of Israel, and he gives them to David. To Jonathan, the prince who might be king, who would be king, is the first person to recognize that David should be king and will be king. And so he sacrifices his own plans, his own glory, his own safety for the sake of his friend. Gives up his relationship with his father. He puts his life on the line. What are we willing to give up for these friends of ours? You know, I think often we're willing to help other people. We're willing to give up things, but not to the point where it hurts us, where it puts ourselves at risk. You know, we might give financially to the point where it affects our own plans. We might give somebody a ride as long as it's going in the right direction. We might volunteer our time if we don't have anything better to do that Saturday. But friendship requires real sacrifice. What we see with Jonathan is a willingness to give up things that we would care about, things that are important to us and are important to others around us. That's what Jonathan did when he put his relationship with his father, his status as prince, and his own life on the line for David. Finally, what does this mean for our lives? What do these teachings about friendship really mean? You know, I think we've talked a lot about how Jonathan exhibited this love and commitment and sacrifice in his relationship to David. And I think that there's some good that can really come from putting ourselves in Jonathan's position to see how we can better be Jonathan's to our friends. How can we better make the decision to show this love and commitment and sacrifice to people? I might have told this story before, but about 10 years ago, I created a holiday, and it was called First Fall Nightfall. And basically the way it is, it's the first evening where it's kind of jacket weather, and you have to put a coat on, and it smells like apple cider and football in the air, and then it doesn't go back to the summer. So it's the first fall nightfall that then leads not to the summer. And so it's a little bit tricky. And the way that you celebrate first fall nightfall is that I will kind of know that it's happening, and then I will send a cryptic text to a friend, because it has to be organic. You can't tell them that it's happening, and they have to read between the lines, and then all of my friends have to get in a car and drive to wherever I am, and then we celebrate. And so usually when I tell this story, one of two things happens. One, it makes me look really selfish in that it is all Tim-centric, or it makes all of my friends look really dedicated and loving and amazing. Sometimes it does both of those things. But in the same way, I think that what we see in Jonathan's life is something that we should be aspiring to, that we should be the type of friends that people take note of. We should be committed and devoted and loving, the type of friends that Jonathan was to David. So that's what we learn from Jonathan's perspective, the importance of being committed and loving and faithful and sacrificial to our friends. But I think what's maybe even more important to take away from this relationship is what we can learn from David's perspective. That David had this intense and natural and desperate need for a true friend when his life was on the line, when he was forging a new path. We all need that as well. There's a book I love about friendship called Sacred Companions by a guy named David Benner. In it, he writes, the supreme gift that anyone can give another is to help that person live life more aware of the presence of God. Sacred companions help us remember that this is our Father's world. They help us hear his voice, be aware of his presence, and to see his footprints as we walk through life. They accompany us on a journey that is made sacred not by their presence, but by the presence of God. Don't we all desperately need that in our lives? Don't we all need someone who will help point us toward God, who would help us recognize God's hand in our lives? Don't we need somebody we can depend on for safety and security, someone who loves us deeply and passionately, who has committed to us and has been covenantly faithful to us, someone who is willing to sacrifice everything on behalf of us? And don't we all have this in the true and better Jonathan in Jesus Christ? Jesus said in John 15, no longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends. For all that I have heard from my Father, I have made known to you. Jesus claims to be our friend. He has exhibited this profound love for us, this covenant faithfulness to us, and his amazing sacrifice on behalf of us. Jesus also said in John, greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. And Jesus has done this for each and every one of us. This morning, will you receive his love and respond to his commitment? Will you let down your guard and your desire for your own space, your own thoughts, your own plans, your own comfort, and give yourself to this amazing friendship that we have in Christ?